for argument, United States versus Smith, Mr. Srebnick.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Scott Srebnick on behalf of Marvin Smith, the appellant in this case. Your Honors, in my allotted time, I'd like to focus on the sentencing issue in my brief. The district
court. Just out of curiosity, forgive me, but just out of curiosity, do you have any idea why Mr. Smith wasn't sentenced in absentia in 1990?
I do not know.
No. Okay.
The rule may have been at the time that district courts could not, and I think it was subsequently amended, but I am not sure about the exact timing.
No, I think, yeah.
But he was not sentenced either in Michigan nor in Wisconsin in absentia,
yeah,
in either case. In any event, when he did come back and when he was apprehended and he was brought to Wisconsin for his sentencing hearing, in the year 2004, the Supreme Court had already decided Blakely, but had not decided Booker. This court had decided its decision in Booker, and so Mr. Smith was really in that period of flux between Blakely and Booker from the Supreme Court. The district court imposed a 30-year sentence without calculating the guideline range, without consulting the guidelines, essentially coming to the conclusion that to sentence Mr. Smith under the guidelines would be error in light of Blakely and in light of the Booker decision from this court. In light of subsequent decisions, namely the Booker case out of the Supreme Court, which requires district courts to at least consult the guidelines in imposing sentence, and most recently the decision out of this court in United States versus Lachey, which I would note Judge Rovner and Judge Ripple were both on the panel, Lachey was a case in which also the district court did not calculate a guideline range, did not resolve the disputes regarding the guidelines, simply imposed a non-guideline sentence. On direct appeal, the appellant's first complaint in his opening brief was that the district court improperly used the guidelines as a guide. When Booker was then decided by the Supreme Court, the appellant then took the somewhat opposite position, his reply brief, that the district court was at least required to calculate a guideline range, and this court agreed and remanded for resentencing. And in that case, the sentence was only a 24-month sentence, and the guideline range that the defendant had urged upon the court was, I believe, 12 to 18 months. The court didn't even engage in a reasonableness inquiry of the sentence because the only issue was whether the district court had consulted the guidelines and calculated a guideline range and resolved the disputes, which the district court had not. In this case, the district court did not resolve guidelines disputes. There were several. The defendant urged a guideline range of 151 to 188 months. The probation officer had recommended 235 to 293, and the district court went far above that and imposed a 30-year sentence for reasons the court articulated, both of which were reasons that the guidelines had accounted for in the probation office's recommendation of 235 to 293, namely Mr. Smith's flight and prior criminal history. So we would submit that under Lachey, which is binding precedent, that this case needs to be resolved in light of Lachey and needs to be remanded for resentencing where the district court should consult the guidelines.
Didn't Smith's lawyer say he didn't want the guidelines to be applied?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't that be binding?
For several reasons. First, that would be an issue, arguably an issue of waiver. But the
arguably,
government.
Well, the arguable part.
Well,
of it.
The arguable is.
He says he doesn't want to be sentenced under the guidelines. The judge says fine. Okay.
The arguable is as follows. First, let me say that the government has not raised waiver in its brief, and under the precedent of this court, the government can waive the waiver argument. Secondly, under Lachey, the defendant arguably, the appellant arguably, perhaps not even arguably, waived the Booker type argument when in his initial brief, he complained that the district court actually consulted the guidelines. So Lachey deals implicitly with the waiver issue. Third, waiver is the intentional relinquishment of a known right. And I don't know how anything really could be considered known during that period post-Blakely, pre-Booker, when all the courts of appeals were in a state of chaos regarding the proper application of the guidelines, whether they could even be applied, whether they were severable, whether courts should impose alternative sentences. There was so much uncertainty at that point that the lawyer simply felt ethically bound, according to what he said, to urge a position that he had heard in seminars, which is that the guidelines can't be severed and that they shouldn't apply.
Well, counsel, even if your client did say he didn't want to be sentenced under the guidelines, the district judge still had an obligation, did he not, to, one, identify the appropriate guideline, and, two, to use that guideline as a guide into sentencing at his discretion.
That's our position. Yes, Your Honor.
Are you familiar with the case of United States against Barrett's? U.S. against Barrett's? Have you?
Familiar? No, Your Honor. No, but I'm familiar with. Is that a case from this court?
It was decided by this very panel, all three of us, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with it. I apologize. But certainly there are other cases from this court, namely Lachey and namely the George case and the Scott case, which says that the district courts need to consult and calculate a guideline range before sentencing. And I think that's clearly what did not happen in this case, and we would urge that the court reverse and remand
for
sentencing.
Now, if the judge does that, could he give your client a higher sentence?
Higher than the high end of the probation range? If he
Heavier than the sentence he gave him.
Higher than 360 months?
Yeah.
Depending on whether or not it would be reasonable under the factors under 3553, whether he consults the guidelines and properly explains the reasons for deviating from the guidelines, I would say no, based on the factors that the court articulated at the original sentencing, which were both factors that the guidelines certainly take into account and certainly were factors that the probation office took into account when the probation office reached the range of 235 to 293. To impose a sentence of higher than 30 years under those circumstances would be, in my view, not a correct application of the guidelines. There's no departure provision of the guidelines that would permit it. And there's nothing else that the court could have articulated that would justify a sentence above 360 months. So
the judge isn't bound by the guidelines anymore.
That's correct. But certainly consulting and calculating them and consulting the departure provision.
That's just the starting point. Right? If the judge has a reasonable ground for abandoning, you know, for giving a higher or a lower sentence, then you know, we're supposed to uphold it.
I don't know the theoretical answer to the question of whether he could. I would have to hear what he has to say. I can tell you this much. Mr. Smith is 67 years old, and he's willing to take his chances on getting a sentence above 30 years on remand.
He's 68.
68 now. So...
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schroeder. Mr. Johnson?
Yes, Your Honors. First, let me address the defendant's sentencing argument. It is true that Judge Clifford didn't calculate the guidelines, but for two reasons, the defendant is not entitled to a resentencing as a result. First of all, there's been some talk about the waiver issue. I don't agree with Mr. Srebnick that the government waived that argument in its brief, although I have to honestly tell you it's not stated all that clearly, but the records...
Well, is it stated at all?
Well, the word waiver is not used, but on pages 42 and 43 of the brief, it's pointed out that the defendant specifically requested proceeding as if the sentencing guidelines were defunct, so that the court had discretion to select any term within the statutory limits of 10 years to life. And then in a footnote, it mentions that the government does not regard this as a plain error case.
Mm-hmm. Can the defendant waive the obligation of the district court under Booker to at least use the guidelines as a framework?
Well, the defendant can waive his right to later argue about it. The defendant here is in a position of having specifically asked the sentencing court to disregard the sentencing guidelines and now coming to this court to ask for a resentencing because the court did not calculate the guideline range. Now, I realize it's procedurally murky because of that sort of indefinite period between Blakely and Booker, so that may not have been unreasonable, but the fact is that Judge Clavert did what the defense specifically asked him to do.
But
Mr. Johnson, what's your view of the role that the Barrett's case should take?
Barrett's did clearly state that the sentencing judges are obligated to calculate the guideline ranges as kind of a starting point to analyzing what the sentence ought to be. However, Barrett's, as well as other cases from this court, have consistently maintained that errors in failing to calculate the guideline range can be harmless errors, and I would suggest to you that this is a case in which any error was clearly harmless.
What is the test to determine if something is harmless error?
The test is whether this court can look at the record and find a reasonable basis to believe that the failure to calculate the guideline range would have had an effect on the outcome. I would suggest here that the record clearly shows that there was no effect and a resentencing would be pointless. And let me explain why I say that. Judge Clavert certainly intended to impose additional time, that is, incarceration beyond the 20 years that the defendant had already received in Detroit. Judge Clavert certainly had the legal authority to do so, both under the statutes, Section 3584 of Title 18, and under the guidelines, Section 5G1.3, both allowed the sentencing judge to give consecutive time. And here, there was certainly a reasonable basis for additional time consecutive to what was imposed in Detroit.
This 20-year sentence, is this a federal sentence?
Yes.
So no parole. And when did he start serving it?
Started serving it a few months. I'm not sure the exact time period, but a few months before the sentencing here. That sentence was also imposed after.
So he'll have to serve, say, 18 years or so under that sentence.
Roughly.
So that brings him up to about 80.
No, 86.
Or above 80. So isn't that enough? Why worry about adding another 10 years? Seems kind of pointless, doesn't it?
Well, that's not a foolish argument by any means. On the other hand, that argument was made to Judge Clavert, and he did not buy it. And the reasons that he didn't buy it, while Mr. Coffey, who was the trial attorney, and others might disagree with that, there was a reasonable basis for the judge to act as he did.
No, I understand the argument, which is that because he was on the lam for 13 years, in effect, he's postponed his imprisonment, so this becomes his kind of old age home.
Well, I don't know that Judge Clavert exactly put it that way.
He preferred his youth, right? He wanted to be out during his youth, relative youth, middle age. But, you know, when you're this old, might as well be in a prison, right? You get good medical care.
I don't recall Mr. Smith
work.
Saying that.
Was the case in any event, Michigan appealed?
That has been resolved.
And that's all resolved.
Yes, the Sixth Circuit affirmed.
There isn't a chance in the world that he won't serve at least 18 more years, right?
Well, I wouldn't say there's not a chance in the world. There's escape. I know that
resume his fugitive status.
I know that a guy in my office has a cartoon up on his door. The lawyer is talking to the defendant. He says, "I'll file for the appeal. You try to escape." In any event, the defendant already had 20 years. For reasonable reasons, Judge Clavert thought he ought to serve additional time. He ended up giving him 30 years concurrent, which was...
makes him 96 when he gets out.
Correct. And that ended up as the equivalent of 10 years consecutive to the 20 he already had. Now, that's 10 years consecutive that Judge Clavert certainly intended to impose and had the legal authority to impose. And that 10 years was the statutory mandatory minimum. In our case, that's the least that Mr. Smith could have gotten. So the only question, really, is whether that 10 years could be imposed consecutive. And I really don't think there's any legal question as to that. And that's why I say that there's no point in remanding this for a resentencing, because whether we agree with Judge Clavert or not, what he did was within his authority, and I don't think would be a reversible error to simply give Mr. Smith the mandatory minimum consecutive to the time he already had. So I would suggest that remanding for a resentencing under the circumstances in this case would be a waste of time, because there's no reasonable basis to believe that the result would be any different. In fact, the cases suggest that the sentencing judge should calculate the guideline range and then should articulate a reason to go outside of that range. If Judge Clavert couldn't articulate a reason, he could end up, if the defense calculation of the guidelines is correct, he could end up saying the least I can give you now is 151 months consecutive.
Out of curiosity, do you know why Mr. Smith wasn't sentenced in absentia?
I don't believe that anyone involved in the case suggested it, and that includes me, because I was one of the attorneys that tried the case originally, and it also includes Judge Evans, who was the presiding judge. I think it just wasn't even considered. And I would say, at least for myself, I wouldn't likely...
Is there a policy on that?
I don't believe we have a policy, but I'm not aware of us ever sentencing somebody in absentia in the Eastern District of Wisconsin.
You know why I find it odd? I find it odd because we're now in a position where, let's say we had to send this case back for retrial. The evidence would be stale. Probably the witnesses would be unavailable. It would really be a mess, wouldn't it?
Well, that's true. On the other hand, if Mr. Smith had been sentenced in absentia, I realize that technically the time limits for filing an appeal and so forth would have run. On the other hand, I think the government would be hard-pressed later to say that Mr. Smith had no post-conviction remedy at all under those circumstances. And I'm not aware that we've ever sentenced somebody in absentia. In fact, there's another fugitive in this case, Kevin Diggs, who also has been convicted. He pled guilty but disappeared before sentencing, and he's still out there somewhere.
Is he in Brazil, too?
I don't know. Maybe Mr. Smith could tell us, but I couldn't.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr.
Thank Johnson. You very much.
Mr. Srebnick, how much time? 2 minutes?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Very briefly. The waiver issue was certainly not raised clearly enough for me to recognize it and file and address it in the reply brief, and I think the court ought to come to the same conclusion when it reads the footnote that he refers to. Secondly, Mr. Johnson spoke a lot about what Judge Clavert could have done. The question, I think, is what would he have done, and does the record show us any indication what he would have done? He had the opportunity, especially post this court's decision in Booker, to state an alternative sentence, to say, I've consulted the guidelines, I've calculated it, and this is the sentence I would impose, and these are the reasons for it. He did not do it. And in fact, he said, if the defendant comes back for resentencing, I'll resentence him on that date and take him as he appears before me on that date, and I'm not going to prejudge that issue. And that's paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he said at the sentencing hearing. So I don't think the court ought to focus on what the district court might have done, but on whether there's anything in the record to show what he would have done. And there is nothing in the record to show what he would have done had he been required or felt bound to at least consult and calculate the guideline range. And this court's decision in Palladino says that the court won't presume that conscientious judges would simply do the same thing if faced with a guideline range that is different than the sentence that the court thought was the appropriate sentence in the case. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Srebnick and Mr. Johnson. Next case.